The good, the bad, and the science. Television movies, comedians, and scientists. The good, the bad, and the science.
Welcome to The Good, the Bad, and the Science, the show that breaks down the science of television and movies with a comedian and a scientist. I'm your host, Ethan Edinburgh, and I've got two wonderful guests joining me today to discuss Mysterious Planet, which you can watch exclusively on Discovery+. My first guest, wow, he is a brilliant writer, actor, comedian, Conan O'Brien's sidekick, and host of the podcast, The Three Questions with Andy Richter. I'm thrilled to welcome to the show, Andy Richter.
Hi, Ethan. How are you?
I'm doing great, Andy. How's it been?
Well, I'm great now that you've buttered me up. I feel very I feel very accomplished and smart.
It is my honor to butter you up, good
thank
sir.
You.
And I really do thank you for being here. I'm a huge, huge, huge fan of yours.
Thank you.
I wanted to also ask you about, you know, we're talking about mysterious planets. So have you visited any exotic locations teeming with weird creatures like the islands we saw on the show?
No, I mean, probably Hawaii would be the because Hawaii is pretty unique. And New Zealand. I've been to New Zealand because New Zealand is also, I worked in New Zealand on a movie a number of years ago. And I had a lot of free time. I had a lot of time off because it was a kids movie and they made the kids work the most. But I had time to go fishing. I like to fish, and I got a guide to take me surf fishing, and we were in an area that was complete wilderness, but there were fences up everywhere. It was like a jungle with fences, and it was to protect kiwis, the birds, because they have no natural predators. So humans coming along and bringing their cats and their dogs and their pet snakes, present just a huge danger to this completely defenseless national bird. And there's a few other, there's a few other species down there that are completely unique to New Zealand and Hawaii. That, the same thing in Hawaii. They're very careful in Hawaii about protecting. I think it's mostly their avian life, mostly their bird life. I don't even know if you can. I mean, pet snakes, I think you got to be real careful in Hawaii. I'm not exactly sure, but they're very particular about that. Yeah,
you got to be careful with your pet snake, regardless.
Exactly.
Jesus,
that's what Grandma said.
Your grandma had a pet snake?
Said, be careful with your pet snake. No. She just, it was a general rule.
She was just telling you that a lot.
Yeah.
Okay, well, our next guest might be able to answer some of these snake-esque questions. Who knows? He is the global managing director for all nature protection at the Nature Conservancy, the world's largest environmental organization. Welcome to the show, Dr. Jeff Parrish.
Thank you, Ethan. And I think Andy's already said everything I want to say about protecting islands from invasive species. So thank you for that, Andy. I can coast the rest of the
sure.
way. But you got it. Yeah, no, I'm happy to be here. I'm a PhD, so hopefully we'll put that hat on at times and hopefully tell you a little some stories about Indonesia and why we got
yes.
to do it. So great to be here.
I'm super curious about Indonesia, and I loved watching it in this show. But before we get to that, I've been hosting this show a few years now, and it always seems somewhat impossible that scientists successfully partner with governments to actually put conservation into law. But I read that you reached a $230 million deal with the government of Chile to manage and permanently finance the 17 national parks of the Patagonia region. So an extremely belated congrats on that. I think it was years ago, but can you tell me how that came to pass and what challenges you faced?
Thanks, Ethan. Well, to be clear and to be fair, we're still in the process of closing out that deal. There was a little thing called a constitutional crisis in Chile, which was long needed, but was really sort of threw the country into a little bit of a pause and a rethink about their constitution. So we're in the process of doing that. The Pew Charitable Trust is out in front leading that. Basically, everyone thinks a national park is awesome, except for when it only receives a fraction of the funding that it needs. And so Chile was actually ninth worst in the world in terms of its investment in its national park system, even though it's absolutely the coolest national parks on the planet. And so our deal was to figure out how can we bring some money to the table that leverages the government up its game in financing its national parks so that people can go see cool things like Torres and Paine and Patagonia National Park that Chris and Doug Tompkins helped to establish. So yeah, so you can do these negotiations with government. It takes a lot of experience and a little bit of leverage and a hell of a lot of carrots and sticks, but it can happen. And that when you do that, man, that it just unlocks protection at scale. It's big, it's what the planet needs. And actually, WWF and Pew and TNC are conjuring up some big ideas to do more of that. So yeah, thanks for asking.
Yeah, of course. I mean, I'm fascinated by that because, like you said, I think it is exactly what we need. It feels like almost every environmental scientist I speak with will agree on that. And yet it's so incredibly difficult. It's such an uphill battle to get these things done.
It is. And, you know, today's a day, too, where parks matter. Parks work. They conserve those kiwis that Andy was talking about. But you know, they also have to be equitable and they have to give access to people of all economic strata, racial, gender, et cetera. They need to benefit people. So, you know, we're increasingly realizing that nature and biodiversity and climate and people are all one big intertwined thing. And you got to make it work for all three. So yeah, that's really what we're about at TNC. And we're doing so with our partners in places like Indonesia, which got me so stoked about this show. I was just like, sorry to take up a minute here, but like I work so hard on conservation. I never get to watch a documentary or a nature show, ever. So you gave me the excuse, man. It was awesome. I felt like a kid in a candy shop. It was great. And it actually got me really pumped up about all the cool stuff going on in Indonesia. Some cool animals, and David Schwimmer did it justice. It was awesome.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, listen, I'm thrilled to give you the opportunity to watch something anytime, you know, anytime you want. Please go ahead, watch whatever you want. Watch The Shining. I don't care. You know, get your kicks, man. So I got to say, the first thing, and Andy, tell me if you feel the same, but the first thing that struck me was how beautiful these places are.
Yeah.
Komodo, Sulawesi. So is that actually how it looks over there, Jeff, or was that all CGI, smoke and mirrors?
Well, it does look that way. But one of the things that struck me, and it doesn't come out in the show, is the fact that we have lost a huge amount of the natural habitat and of those forests and on all of those islands. And so, you know, you don't want to show death and destruction when you're trying to get people stoked, right? And I get it. So there's a little bit of exaggeration there because there's a lot of palm oil on many of those islands and these huge plantations that are wiping out some of the richest biodiversity and carbon, right? Remember, carbon starts in nature. Sometimes it's under the ground in the form of you know, from fossilized remains. And sometimes it's actually in trees and in soil and in peatlands. And all of Indonesia has a ton of carbon that we want to keep in the ground. Unfortunately, we're losing a lot of that. The show didn't really show it, but man, it is beautiful. And that's, I have to say, I was inspired. It wasn't all CGI. There are parts of it that we still need to protect that look just like that. And I was like, again, I was giddy. It was really cool to see some of that beauty.
Wow. Have you been over there yourself?
I have actually. You know, it was total serendipity, but I've been directly to Komodo. I've been face to face with a Komodo dragon. And I didn't know that was going to be the star of the show when you sent out the request. And so I was pretty stoked. In fact, I've got like a piece of furniture right here, carved out Komodo dragon, that one of my most prized possessions. They are the most kick-ass animals. And that I remember walking across Komodo Island. We spent a lot of time with beautiful coral reefs around the island. And then we went on land and we did this hike all the way across the top. And not only were there Komodo dragons, but there were fossils everywhere, more common than the common rock. Like there were fossils all across that island. Those beautiful, you know, nudibranch fossils, those shells that like fully intact. And I just remember like thinking this whole thing is prehistoric. Between the Komodo dragon and fossils laying everywhere, it was an extraordinary place. One of the most memorable moments of my life.
Wow. And, Andy, tell me if you heard that right, but did you say that you killed a Komodo dragon and made a furniture out of it? You made a chair out of it? What was that?
He did say something like that.
It's a carved thing right here. I know I mentioned that to one of my colleagues. They were like, wait, are you talking taxidermy? Like, that's kind of gross.
Yeah, I thought they were like endangered. You're a freak.
But it just goes to show you how these creatures are really important to the traditions of local people, and that they actually carve, they make art from these creatures and the model of those creatures. And so, again, back to that issue of people and biodiversity are pretty intertwined.
Well, I definitely have questions about the Komodo. I mean, like you said, it was the star of the show. I've never seen one in person. I guess because they're only on these islands across the world from us. But yeah, can you tell me a little bit about them as a species? I understand they have like a super venomous bite. Is that true?
That is true. I'm not a herpetologist, which is the big fancy word for somebody who studies lizards and snakes and amphibians, but that is true. For a while, people thought it was the bacteria that would kill their when they bite their prey, that it was the bacteria in their saliva, like as if they were just like really, really bad at brushing their teeth. But basically, it is the venom. It is this venom, just like you have in a snake. And it kind of, I mean, David Schwimmer said it right. It is a blood thinner. They're big, big creatures. I mean, they're huge. They deserve the name dragon. But, you know, it's hard for them to take down the water buffalo. And so oftentimes they'll grab it and then they'll actually go chomp on it once it's gone off to die. So they may not kill it right there in the moment, but their venom eventually will.
I really liked Schwimmer, by the way. We should mention that he was narrating this doc. And it was kind of unique, right? I mean, Andy, how did you feel about that? They kind of did like a funnier take on the normal Planet Earth move.
I was offended. Leave comedy to the professionals. I don't want biologists writing jokes. No, I mean, there was some good lines in there, but there was some parts where I was kind of like, okay, I don't need, you know, like, take it down a notch. Like, if there's a comedy dial, I would just ask the producers to turn it down like 10%, because it just, when I watch a nature documentary, and I love nature documentaries, and I love nature, and I know a fair amount about things just from over the years being into nature documentaries, like, I'm not really looking for comedy. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And it does sort of undercut what I want to be thinking about. You know, I don't need pop culture references in the middle of my Komodo dragon thing. Yeah. Like I said, there were some good lines in there, but there was other times too when I was just like, just let me look at the bugs getting eaten. You know, let me look at the tarsier. And it's also too, I mean, I can't imagine what it's like to program for nature documentaries when there are so many. And I think there's probably, I'm just guessing from knowing television, that there's the group of people that are into or that watch nature documentaries is a pretty set group. I bet it doesn't fluctuate a lot. And people who are into it are into it. So everybody is always trying to get more people to watch something. So they're trying different things. You know, they're trying, you know, in this case, comedy. You know, there's a lot of shows. You know, there's like a lot of prehistoric shows. And they did a little bit here with CGI reenactments of things that, you know, which can be really cool. You know, the time lapse of the changing of the water levels of these islands is really fascinating. And I'm always kind of fascinated by the notion of what did where I'm standing look like a million years ago. I also like to know about the interaction of people with it, you know, because it sent me to, you know, the internet to look up Komodo and how many people live on Komodo and how long they've been living on Komodo, because it is such a rugged place. And it does seem that the human habitation is very centralized and very in a very small place on that big island. And I think that's always like, I, you know, just the shots when they had like of a village and Komodo dragons strolling around. I mean, I'd love to know more about like, what's that like to have, it's a venomous lizard as big as a motorcycle strolling around outside your house, you know?
All right, we're going to take a quick break and we'll be right back.
Hey, everyone. This is Jesse David Fox, host of Good One, a podcast about jokes. I am proud to announce that I have personally won the Streaming Wars. And there's a new docu-special on Peacock based on our own Vulture podcast. Good One, a show about jokes, follows Mike Birbiglia as he develops new material, taking audiences through the process of transforming personal stories into stand-up. Featuring interviews with Mike's family and comedy colleagues like Seth Meyers, Hasan Minhaj, and Asko Akatsuka, Good One, a show about jokes, is streaming now only on Peacock.
The break is over. Here we go, back to the show about science.
Yeah, I thought that was actually really... That part was kind of cool and a little bit of vengeance, you know?
Like, yeah,
you know,
yeah.
He was ready to... He was seeking revenge. But, yeah. You know, it did... I think they failed to talk about the people, right? Like that, and that... I'm with Andy. I also think... So, little story. I left the Nature Conservancy. I'm a prodigal son. I came back to TNC fairly recently. And when I left, I worked with the clothing company Patagonia on this campaign. And there's a famous mountaineer, one of my inspirations, a guy named Rick Ridgway. And we had this long breakfast when he was hiring me. He looked me looked me in the eye across the table. He's like, "Jeff, conservation, you conservation people are not going to save the world. A story is going to save the world." And I was like, I thought he had three heads and 12 eyes. I thought he was so weird, but he was so right. And so to Andy's point, like, turn it down a little bit, David, done like 10 notches. But I also really appreciated the fact that he's telling a good story that's bringing in other audiences. And instead of like reaching to the converted, we're reaching to the unconverted. And so that was, I've got a new level of appreciation for that, even as a PhD scientist. Like, you know, usually people of my ilk are like walking around pshawing every single freaking, you know, conversation like that one, right? Because they're like, "Oh, those facts are not true." And my wife always gives me a hard time because we'll be sitting in the movie theater and we'll be in, like, it's based in New Zealand, right? And this big drama. And then I hear a hermit thrush, which only occurs in the eastern United States. I'm like, "Oh, for Christ's sake."
Yeah.
So, but I can appreciate...
My pet peeve is bald eagles that have hawk voices.
Right.
That, every time.
A bald eagle flies by in the air. You know.
Andy, that's exactly right. I'm an ornithologist, actually.
Yeah. Oh, are you?
Yeah. So, like, you know, to hear the hawk coming out of the eagle's mouth is, like, way over the top.
Yeah.
It makes Swimmer look pretty on track.
The comedy did get me a few. At the beginning, I was worried about it, and I thought, like, oh, no, a third of this dialogue is going to be, you know, jokes, and I don't need et cetera. And then every now and then it would get me, and I'd be like, okay, hold on a second. That was actually kind of fun and unique because, we don't normally get that. You mentioned the tarsiers, the spectral tarsiers I wrote down because I was fascinated by – I love – that was probably my favorite part of the episode because it just seemed like a weird sci-fi creature to me. Like normally a sci-fi villain or a horror villain kind of has like one super special power, you know, and this thing, they just kept going and it was hilarious to me. It was like the huge eyes, it can see moonlight in color, super powerful legs, it can jump, it's got these like sticky like claw hands. It's like it has everything.
I just kept thinking like Yoda lives and he's badass, right?
Yeah, exactly. He's fast and hungry. Can you tell us about these little critters? I love these guys.
Well, Andy's been watching all the documentaries. He might know more than I do. They're a really small primate. You kind of forget that like these little guys are actually, you know, related to monkeys and chimps and orangs, which are, you know, on the next island over, right? And so they're fascinating. They're like the pinnacle of evolution, right? That they can actually be able to perform like that at nighttime and see color from the moonlight what I loved was, and I didn't know this actually, that they couldn't move their eyes in their sight, but they were so large that they couldn't move them around. And therefore, like an owl, which I totally understand, have to move their body, their neck around. Yeah. And so that was just so cool. But I thought the coolest thing was watching them hunt, right? That jumping and the accuracy and the ability to latch onto something and at the same time grab a grasshopper, like they were definitely badass.
Yeah, so cool.
That aspect of the fact that their eyes are so, evolved to be so big that they couldn't turn in their sockets is just, I love that there's always a yin and a yang of like you can't have it all. If you want eyes that are big enough to see moonlight in color, they you can't turn them. You know, like sorry, it just won't work. Like there's even like engineering limits in nature. You know, it's yes. Like you can't if you want to have this small a head and you want to have you know because I'm sure that like. You know, one of the advantages of them being so tiny is hard for predators to get. You know, they can and bugs are plentiful. If they were bigger, bugs wouldn't be a big enough protein source.
Good point.
So mm-hmm. it's like all these kind of balanced things that fit together, and their teeth those. Scary little teeth. It's so great because they do. They it's you know it's like a it's like in an animated movie like just that turn from cute to evil is just it's a good gimmick that always works. You know,
those car suits had that in spades for sure. You know, it's kind of like Ethan. I know maybe we're going to talk a little bit about evolution, but you know how we all got like a little weirder during the pandemic and we were all in isolation? We all got a little stranger. We all like, I don't know. Okay. You guys aren't laughing. I think maybe.
Yeah. Because it's not funny. It's like, it's just true.
Yeah, I know. Right. We're all like,
I got cool as shit.
Does it show? But it's that's kind of what islands do, right? Is that they're, you know, things that, nature forces certain adaptations, and you're doing that in isolation, like we were all during the quarantine. So, like the tarsier is just that spectral tarsier is absolutely the epitome of that, right? Like, you know, cute and cuddly and badass and mean as shit. And, you know, and you kept seeing that, like the meliophile. Like, I was just like, oh my God, like I'm an ornithologist. And I, you know, the fact that I thought it was CGI when they all came in. All the different pairs who mate for life, I thought was quite cool. My wife told me to say that, but actually, like how they all came in together and started like digging, and I thought that was hilarious because I was like, "This is like a Three Stooges kind of like nest totally. Building thing," but that's just weird. It's just weird and cool. But islands kind of do that, you know. It's an amazing thing about islands and island biogeography.
Is there a lot of human settlement on Sulawesi? Like, is there a is there a decent amount of people on Sulawesi too?
Yeah, far more than on Komodo. Yeah, for sure.
And that's is there the palm oil plantations on Komodo also?
Not on Komodo, to my knowledge. But it's actually been I should preface by saying that it's been about 20 years since I was there, so I'd actually be fascinated to see the changes 15, 20 years. But
I'll go check it out.
Certainly on a lot of the other islands, like Kalimantan, Sulawesi, Sumatra, just hammered. And we're trying to do some work with some of those more, you know, forward-thinking. Look, agriculture has to happen, right?
Yeah.
We can all diminish our palm oil use and make sure it's, quote-unquote, more sustainable. But one of the things we're trying to do is make sure that palm oil is not like a sea of palm oil, creating even further islands within islands of forest. That was the irony, too. We're talking a lot about islands as if they were just an island within the sea. But there are islands within these islands because of human. Humans are creating seas of destruction in agriculture, et cetera. But there are ways to do that that are more regenerative to nature, that make corridors so that creatures like a tarsier can move from patch to patch, which is what animals really need to survive, you know, for genes to flow. And with climate change, you got to have that connectivity. And there are some of these players who are more willing to think about that when they think about their plantations and leaving large patches for nature and benefiting from like the pollination that comes out of the forest, or leaving quarters so that animals can move around. So, you know, that's the world we're in today. It's a warmer, more crowded world, and we just got to figure out how do you balance those things of nature protection and feeding people, too. So it was interesting that was missing from the show, right?
Is there ways to make governments and corporations to incentivize them to be more ecologically sound in a way that rather than just because it's the right thing to do, or it's because, you know, the way – It's totally. And especially, you know, with subsistence farmers, like to tell them, well, this is, you know, it's a question of morality. They're like, I got to feed my kids, you know.
Yeah, 100%.
I mean, is there a good way? Is there ways that we're finding to say to companies, it affects your bottom line to do this better, and if you know, and to governments to like this, there is an. Not just the intrinsic value of being ecologically sound, there's also it's within your benefit, you know.
100%, Andy. I mean companies have done that on climate, right? They're like, holy shit, our bottom line is gonna suffer, and therefore we better commit to these big climate goals. And so people are starting to do it around nature as well, realizing that we've got a climate crisis but also a biodiversity crisis. I just came back from Belize. It's actually, you know, the first trip outside the country because of the quarantine since I came back to TNC. But I met with the prime minister there, and he clearly gets it. He realizes that their economy is in the shambles right now, and they really need to be thinking about that and feeding people. And so, you know, why would he not like just pave over everything and get more agriculture? And there's plenty of demand for it. But he really feels that they have, first of all, have branded themselves as a nature-based economy, as a blue economy, a green economy. And that actually sends a hell of a lot more people to Belize to travel there than the place that's completely wiped out and destroyed. So people go to see the jaguars and the macaws and the coral reefs. And now they need to do more, but he recognizes that the tourism economy that they have, albeit, you know, it's under pressure during a pandemic, but he gets it. He's like, the tourism economy, our fish, we have more fish when we have marine protected areas because the fish breed and create babies there, and then they leave those protected areas, those nurseries, and then we've got more fish to catch. The same with even their agriculture. If we protect, we just protected 230,000 acres of the Mayan rainforest, the Selva Maya, last year with our partners, and that patch of forest actually literally is sending pollinators out to the farmland that surrounds it, which they really struggle in there. And so companies, farmers, you know, countries and governments, they're starting to get it. And I think people like the Prime Minister of Belize are clearly walking the talk too.
All right, we're going to take a quick break and we'll be right back.
The break is over. Here we go back to the show about science.
So there's hope, Andy. I think there are some places, though. I mean, you know, look, Brazil's is not got an environmental friend right now. There are other places around the world where we struggle, but where there are willing governments and we can use those carrots and sticks to help them do the right thing, man, we're all over it.
Well, I also got a shout out then, the Prime Minister of Belize. Thank you so much. So this person rules. I hope you listen to the show. Come on anytime.
You know, that's the first place I ever saw a jaguar. Was in Belize.
Wow.
And I was actually 16 years old. I was with a group of high school kids from Birmingham, Alabama, where I grew up. We drove from Birmingham to Belize.
Wow.
And, which was awesome. And it was late one night. We're driving into the Coxcomb Basin Preserve, which is a really famous jaguar preserve. And sure enough, I mostly saw its ass, but I didn't really. But it was still pretty cool. But I'm really they have been tremendous leaders, and it's been cool. And you know, there again, if there are places of little spotlights of hope, you know, I mean that tropical rainforest. Kind of like in Borneo and Sumatra and Sulawesi is like a hotbed for biodiversity in the Americas and for carbon. And so that forest is the second largest rainforest in the Americas. So in this hemisphere outside of the Amazon, and it's under threat. And so, you know, anything that people are doing to value it. So even like now you're talking about corporates, Ethan, you know, those same new condos that are coming in and the much nicer resorts that are now there, they all know that they've got to give back because no one's going to come to Belize if it's mowed down, right? They just, even if people never take a trip out, just knowing that Belize is there and you can hear Belize's nature is there and you can hear the birds, like, you know, if it was mowed down, people are not going to come. So
they just go to Miami. I mean, why make Belize Miami? Because you can just go to Miami. God. It's closer.
Right.
I was actually about to say I'm from Miami, and that you can mow down. Just, I mean, like, there's a bunch of, I can give you addresses, Jeff, that you can just, there, just wait, you make a bunch of palm oil.
It'll be an underwater park in no time. Just,
right. Climate change is catching up.
Well, listen, there's plenty of Central Florida and Northern Florida that I would also be fine with you mowing down and creating a bunch of palm oil or whatever and leave these, you know, beautiful untouched islands to themselves. That's what tears me apart, I got to say, when I see these documentaries, because like you were talking about the fossils that are there. And to me, when I'm watching this episode, I'm thinking, man, this seems like it was exactly the same as it was hundreds of years ago, thousands of years ago. So to hear that there's also settlements, corporations, plantations, you know, palm oil, like, it just seems so backwards to me. It just seems like clearly this is not the area to do that.
Look, Indonesians have every right to have a, you know, sustainable livelihoods and govern, you know, as much as you and I do. And we've all benefited from that privilege. So I think and we're part of the problem too, right? On the other side of the world in terms of our consumption. And that, you know, that said, we're increasingly realizing that we are all on this planet, this little lifeboat together, and we need to work together. And so that's why we're trying to figure out other ways where we can make it even easier for the government of Indonesia to, you know, by working with our partner YCAN there, you know, to help them help Indonesia, right? Like, because it's not an easy task. They've got a lot of people under the poverty line, right? So it's a tough one. I mean, there is no longer wilderness left on the planet. I hate to break it to you. So even the wild places are still impacted by, you know, by smoke from climate-induced fires or noise pollution, you know? And so we have to figure out how do we get things on the lifeboats of parks and indigenous lands and help make sure that they can survive, you know, going into this next day. This is actually the last decade we have left. Sorry, just to bum out. This is supposed to be a comedy. Yeah, I just thought I'd, like, you know, put a little dash of sobriety on it. But it's the last decade we've got left to get this right, and we're doubling.
Oh, I thought you meant just in general.
Not in general, like, yeah, right? But now to get the you know, the nature piece right, the climate piece right, and okay. So we got to double down, man, and keep those forests in Sulawesi standing.
Yeah, I hope that you do, and if you need help again, Tallahassee, Jacksonville. These are large areas. We don't need them. Trust me, we don't need them. And climate-wise, I mean, they mentioned that every 100,000 years, we have an ice age. So I assume that the global warming's not a problem because we got another one around the corner somewhere.
Yeah, that was a little bit of hyperbole. But we do. The world goes through these shifts, but this is the first time it's gone through a human-induced shift of climate. And so, you know, it's a, I wouldn't rest on my laurels with that, with the hopes that that
although when you think, you know, in terms of, like, you know, ownership, man, talk about badass. We fucked up an entire planet, you know, just like, what other species has fucked up an entire planet?
Yeah, dude. Jaguars are cool, and like Jeff mentioned, they have awesome asses, but they've never taken down a whole planet. Haven't. That's pretty sick.
I mean, sure, maybe a giant asteroid, but I mean, come on, for just, like, you know, evolved apes, that's pretty incredible.
Yeah,
that's pretty cool. Got to give it up.
Good point, it's awesome. Andy. Way to go, everybody. No, I mean, I'm making a joke, but it boggles the mind. Just that sometimes I think our brains are a little too big, you know, like if we weren't so smart, there wouldn't be a hole in the ozone. You know what I mean?
If we just lose that greed gene, you know, there's somewhere on the chromosome, it's there. We just need to slice it off.
Okay, there was one more thing I really had to ask about, which was this small segment they did on what they called The Hobbit, which is the actual name of this, like, skeleton, these bones they found in 2003. Do you know about this guy they found, Jeff?
I am no anthropologist. I heard about this in the news. It was fairly, you know, past decade or so where they discovered it, right? And but I actually And I question, I may be wrong, but I wasn't sure, even sure if there had actually been overlap of the human, you know, the human species.
But I mean, when you think about it, there were probably lots of little primates, you know, that kind of ended up, I mean, because it doesn't take much to look at a chimp or a gorilla and go, oh, it's kind of human, you know, I mean, as opposed mm-hmm. to a deer or a dog or some other kind of, you know, any other creature. There's similarities there between us and monkeys. So it's like, yeah, I bet you there's probably ones that just haven't been discovered yet or won't be discovered because they just didn't leave any trace of, you know, odd little ape-like creatures that, yeah, maybe, you know, maybe that was could have been us, you know.
Yeah, it seemed like a kind of strange, almost like a different documentary was like sliced up and placed into this one for a second. Because I was like, oh, wait a minute. Now we're talking about like early man. This is like a mini human. And then we're moving on. So I was just like, whoa, what happened there? Did we just discover another species and then not talk about it? But anyway, you brought up these chimps that were similar to, and one of them was in this also, the crested macaque, if I'm not mistaken. which I might be because I'm often mistaken.
Yeah.
But apparently they live in like these huge groups, and there was a claim I wanted to ask you about, Jeff. They said that they are a peaceful species because they have expressive faces.
You know,
can you comment on that?
That was a little bit of the Dave going a little over the top, I think. But what? Okay. But now, that said, it's probably the other way around, that the faces and their expressions that they can have evolved to minimize some conflicts. But the pressures, the evolutionary pressures were likely that they have better survival rates when they work together, right? And so that's what primates can do. Okay. We are primates too, right? Like it took, you know, your producers and everybody to put this whole thing together, right? And we were able to.
I could have done it myself.
Yeah, it was all of you. Yeah, but they, you know, so I thought the fact that they have expressive faces is not like what drove evolution. It was a little bit of the other way around. So you know, again, a little bit of hyperbole. But you know, I have to say, like when they were taking the picture and the macaques were all like jockeying to get into the picture, I was like, that's just like my daughters with a selfie, right? like TikTok. Look like an early version of TikTok, but I thought they were cool, man. I mean, we have a lot to learn from them, don't we?
To me, it's like, it's when they yawn and those teeth, those dagger teeth, it's like, that's probably, the threat of those probably keeps them peaceful more than anything because, if I had teeth like that and somebody I was having a struggle with had teeth like that, I don't think we'd bite each other because we'd be like, it's like a little tiny nuclear option is to be bitten with those things.
Speaking of teeth on a predator, there's actually, I don't know if you came across this, Ethan, but on Sulawesi, there was actually a new species of predator found about the past 10 years. And like, you think we've discovered everything? But there's actually a little creature called a civet, and it's a
cat, right?
Kind of like a cat, a felid, but it's a long like a cat, and it's not going to like take out a macaque, but I thought that was kind of cool when I was, you know, doing a little bit of research myself. I was like, you know, there's still stuff to discover. So every time we want to be like doom and gloom and listen to dumbasses like me who are like, this is the last decade we have left. You know, there's still cool stuff out there to discover, and Indonesia is one of them, man. I mean, it's probably thousands of other species that we haven't discovered yet, and maybe we won't before we mow them down. But you know, we should at least try. And so I thought, you know, it's a cool place. I mean, I thought the show, and it was inspirational. It was I thoroughly enjoyed it. So kudos to Discovery with a little bit of that dial turned down.
I mean, unless they get Andy, in which case, turn it up, I say.
Yeah, right, exactly.
Speaking of your career, Andy, we are running short on time here, but if there's something else you want people to check out, I mean, obviously your podcast is fantastic. If you want to, you know, tell people about that, please go ahead.
Sure. I have a podcast called The Three Questions, and it's available wherever your podcasts come out of. And it's basically the three questions. It's I wanted to do sort of have the kind of conversations that I've always liked to have with people. And, you know, a lot of the guests are entertainment, you know, a lot are kind of comedy, because that's just kind of what's in the turning in the froth of my world. And but the questions are, where do you come from? Where are you going? And what have you learned? And the idea is to just kind of, I like when people think about their lives and think about how they are and think about how those two things intersect and what control you have over those forces, you know, your environmental forces, your own drive, your own will, and how they form who you are. You know, it's just therapy. It's just all, I've been too much therapy. I got to do something with it.
That's awesome.
So I'll do a podcast.
Well, I'm glad that you are. I think it's awesome. Love the show. Thank you so much for coming on this show. Like I said, you know, I've just been a huge fan of yours for so many years. You're in like all of my favorite things.
Thank you. It
just means a lot to me. And Jeff, anything you want to tell people about?
No, just first of all, Andy, it's a pleasure to be with you. Ethan, this, I love your show. This is awesome. I'm glad we talked about trying to save the stuff we saw on the show. Thank you for that. And you can just go to nature.org or you can follow me at Parish Nature. And happy to. And actually, as I was saying before, it's not about the Nature Conservancy alone. It's about all these organizations working hard. And so we're working for some radical collaborations to change the world. And hey, let's keep up the good fight and maybe have a little less of the Schwimmer comedy on the dial. But I appreciate you both.
David right, Schwimmer sitting somewhere and feeling a smack and being like, "What's that coming from?"
He is not going to follow. He's not going to follow us on Twitter. I don't think.
I don't think so.
Schwimmer, come on the show and combat me. Let's go. All right. Thank you guys so much. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Ethan.
It's a pleasure.
Thank you, Jeff.
Thank you so much. Thank you, Andy and Ethan.
Get exclusive science shows, nature documentaries, and more real-life entertainment on Discovery Plus. Go to discoveryplus.com/goodbadscience to start your 7-day free trial. That's discoveryplus.com/goodbadscience.
Good, the bad, the science, credits. Hosted and produced by Ethan Merck, executive producer Brett Kushner, supervising producer Emily Feld, producer Darby Rose, editor Michael Feld, talent booker Samantha Barella, post coordinator Jason McCarris, and research PA Ali Rubenstein.